This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. WNYC Studios is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Protein degradation can target and destroy cancer-causing proteins right inside the cell. It's how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Here at home, everyone will have the privilege of making whatever self-denial is necessary, not only to supply our fighting men, but to keep the economic structure of our country fortified and secure during the war and after the war.
By the spring of 1942, the U.S. had entered its first few months of World War II, which by then had been raging for years. The front line was in Europe, but FDR, in a fireside chat, let Americans know that the sacrifice would extend to their own doorsteps, their own hearts, their own pantries.
This will require, of course, the abandonment not only of luxuries, but of many other creature comforts. Every loyal American is aware of his individual responsibility.
Today, those of us in self-isolation make a sacrifice. It's our duty to sit inside, and many of us watch our livelihoods evaporate to flatten the curve. But what of the government's duty to us? On Wednesday, the IMF published a blog post calling on governments to implement wartime-like economic measures around the globe. Quote, in a war, massive spending on armaments stimulates economic activity and special provisions ensure essential services. In this crisis, things are more complicated, the economists wrote. But governments should step in with measures like a freeze on evictions, paid sick leave, and cash transfers to the unemployed. In Foreign Policy last week, economic historian Nicholas Mulder noted that the idea of a war economy has come to mean many things: productivity, sacrifice, reform, solidarity, and resourcefulness. And that the rhetoric of wartime idealism spills over into economic policy that can have an impact lasting long after the armistice is signed. Nicholas, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me on, Brooke.
You wrote, war economies don't suspend politics, they raise the stakes.
That's right. Right now, for example, when you look at approval ratings, Trump's approval ratings have gone up a bit, and in many other democracies, the approval ratings of incumbent leaders have gone up. So it seems like a huge incumbency advantage. But only time will tell whether the coronavirus crisis will provide a lasting political benefit, because it's exactly because people now seem to put a lot of faith in leaders that these leaders can also squander that trust much more quickly. So I think that what seemed to be a kind of rallying around the flag effect could very quickly turn into mass disillusionment.
You wrote that there is a tendency for more progressive policies to come out of war economies. I'm not convinced.
Your skepticism is very understandable, because wars, we associate them with this effect where politics is sort of suspended and everyone just agrees to do what the government tells them. But if we actually look at both World War I and World War II, that was not at all what came out of those wars. In fact, the organization and militancy of labor, also the claims of veterans, of widows, disenfranchised groups like African Americans in the United States, made much larger claims to participation in society afterwards. Forces are unleashed in wartime economies that even governments that have conservative politics will find it quite difficult to restrain.
But writing in Dissent last week, historian Tim Barker, did you read that piece?
Yes.
He urged us to stay away from war analogies, or more to the point, to stay away from using national security as a basis for action, because it could also be used as a rationale for even more draconian immigration policies, for xenophobia. Do you worry when we pull a lever that is so associated with real war?
Tim Barker's argument is very acute about warning about the dangers, and I agree with that. I would just differ slightly from him in emphasizing that we currently are, of course, not in a war. I've actually been quite surprised that it has taken so relatively long for Trump and Trumpists to turn coronavirus into arguments against immigration. I would have thought they would have done that much more quickly. But even as they are doing that, they're still reliant on China and other East Asian countries right now for providing supplies. Last Sunday, there was a big airlift of supplies from East Asia that arrived at JFK of masks, gowns, gloves, thermometers. And I think that that was already happening in World Wars I and II, which are remembered as moments of increased nationalism, of course, mm-hmm. and of national self-reliance and self-sufficiency. But in fact, already at that point, there were very globalized supply chains. And even the American war effort was dependent not just on raw materials from abroad, so rubber from Latin America and Africa and Asia, tin, aluminium, etc. America was using its productive base in order to build equipment that the rest of the world used in order to fight fascism. That's something that right now, interestingly, is kind of inverted. We're in a lend-lease in reverse situation because most of the production of medical equipment happens in East Asia. And so both the United States and Europe are having to rely on an air bridge now that is being established from East Asia to Europe and the United States. We're still in that very international moment. It's just that the flows are going in the other direction this time.
You wrote that this wasn't so much a problem of prioritizing expenditures or limited resources. The big issue in this case, maybe the unique issue, is sustaining circulation when people are in lockdown. You call this the ventilation or butter dilemma, as opposed to the old guns and butter one. Could you fill that out for me?
The old dilemma of guns and butter is essentially about priority. What do you do when you have a limited set of resources and you must choose in the short term to spend them on defense, on military production, that's the guns part, or on civilian production, that's butter. Now, a lot of people have been arguing that what we face now is this choice between saving lives and restarting the economy. What we're really dealing with here is whether we can freeze the economy for as long as is needed to control the virus, or sacrifice enormous amounts of lives to continue the circulation. And that's why I called it ventilation or butter, because whether we keep the economy on a sort of life support or want to continue production and circulation at all costs.
You said that the war itself will not necessarily give us what we want politically for the future, but we can see that it creates a common morality. But for how long?
If you look at World War II, the kind of moral economy that came out of that conflict, the idea that when people have to mobilize to confront a common threat, they have to put their lives on the line fighting, or they have to put their labor, forego wage increases, forego freedoms that they have in peacetime, then they will also demand a lot back for it when that situation ends. World War II created a kind of moral order that I think persisted for decades in the United States when it came to burden sharing, redistribution, what sort of public services are deemed normal and general and shared. The end of that order didn't come until the late 70s and early 1980s. It persisted for four decades after the war. So I think that the changes can be quite long-lasting.
But, I mean, you're looking at our government now, right? At President Trump and this Congress. You think that this crisis and this use of wartime economic policies can ignite a similar sense of responsibility from them?
I think it's important to look beyond Trump in this regard. Having the right institutions and policies also matters. And I still think that there is a lot that we can do that will be in place for the next president. I find it very difficult to predict what the ultimate political upshot of this crisis will be for politics. But it's certain that the challenge of climate change is exactly the kind of long-run problem for which we need state capacity. State capacity that this crisis has exposed is missing in the United States. The point of building a strong healthcare and planning and administrative state is that you have a well-functioning government, no matter who's in power.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me on, Brooke.
Nicholas Mulder is an economic historian at Cornell University. His article in Foreign Policy is called "The Coronavirus War Economy Will Change the World."
One other thing worth saying is just there's this expression that we're all Keynesians in a foxhole. So the ideas of John Maynard Keynes, which was basically the idea underneath a lot of war economics and the welfare state. Because we all, you know, even people who normally don't like government and state action, in an emergency situation will intervene in order to save themselves using the power of government and the state.